session number 21564, reel 9.
Colonel Cormac, reel 9. After Operation Commando, were there any other significant occurrences that you can recall?
Yes, there were one or two. I think most of the really interesting ones were to do with mine laying in various shapes or forms. And the two incidents that stuck in my mind, one I called Hill Mistake. That was when we were doing a fairly major night mine laying operation for the 3rd Battalion, the Royal Australian Regiment. And it was quite a bit out in front. And we had to take our vehicles up to a safe, we thought a safe rendezvous RV, and carry all our mines and wiring and pickets for the fence forward. It was quite a major operation, a considerable march in darkness to the place where we had done a recce beforehand. And because we were out in front, we had arranged a protection party from the Australians to give us some cover while we could operate safely and hope that we wouldn't be interrupted.
So this would be what, a standing patrol?
It was a fairly large patrol, yes. Mm. It would be almost a platoon-sized effort to...
Would they be sort of laid out in a skirmish line ahead of you, or in... Do you know what sort of formation they would adopt on the ground to protect you?
Not really. I was quite happy that they were there.
Yes.
And how they sorted themselves out on the ground, I left to them, because they knew the area we were operating, or at least I thought they did. Anyway, we were in radio communication with them, and we had checked that they were in position as agreed, and they confirmed that they were. At the same time, I took the chance to set out my own brain gun team just as additional protection and possibly slightly closer as a precaution. And they had an 88 set, so they could let me know if anything was happening quickly. And I asked if they had seen our friends, and they replied that they hadn't, but there was all quiet. So we carried on with our mine laying, completed the operation, which took few hours. It was quite a considerable hand-laid field with the proper fence and red triangles round and so on. And then we came back to the place our vehicles had been left to find our drivers in a very jittery state.
How far back would that be?
The carry was several hundred yards. And it seemed longer at night carrying all these things. We all took a hand in carrying boxes of mines and so on. And the drivers in the small protection party had said that they had just seen a fairly large Chinese patrol drifting past in the night, very quietly, took them by surprise, but they weren't interfered with. Whether the Chinese decided not to do anything or they had another aim in mind, I don't know. But the mere fact that they were there gave my drivers and party quite a fright.
Had your protection party, your Bren gun team, seen them? Or
No, they hadn't, because they were well behind us. They had seen nothing. And as we left, I withdrew them and told the friends that we had finished and that they could go. But it was only on the way back that afterwards that we discovered that they were, in fact, protecting us behind us. Instead of being out in front, they had gone to the wrong hill, and that was why it was called Hill Mistake.
Was this just a navigational error of direction and distance?
It was just a simple... A navigational error. The maps that we used were reasonably good, but they were not as accurate as we were used to, say, in Northwest Europe. I would have to say that. And it wasn't difficult to make a mistake over a particular spur or re-entrant or hill that might vary in feet by a small margin from the proper one. So it was understandable, and I'm glad we didn't know about it at the time.
Did the Chinese patrol get away entirely without any contact?
Yes, there was no... Actually, they just drifted past our vehicle park, which was slightly concealed, but not much. They could hardly fail to notice them, but they chose not to. They just gave our drivers a hell of a fright.
Could be they were trying not to attract attention.
I would suspect so. And going on their merry way, showing that they could infiltrate certain parts at night.
How many vehicles did you have in the vehicle park, and what?
There would only be, I think, a Jeep and about and two three-tonners.
Carrying your mines?
Yes, that would be about the size of it.
Did you have any other encounters with the Chinese patrols at night?
Well, a similar one was again involved in night mine laying, and we were mine laying for either the KOSB or the KSLI, I can't remember which, I think it was the KSLI, again at night, and we had brought our mine vehicles up to a point behind the sort of line, and again carried our mines, pickets and wire forward, and to carry out our mine laying, and we were very close to the boundary between the KOSB and the KSLI, and we had arranged that they both knew, this was standard drill of course, that we were going out and when we were going out and about what time we expected to finish, and that we would have to move in and out from the minefield because you could only carry a limited amount of mines for that period to get some more. And I had sent my vehicles back to the troop base or wherever the mines were from under one of my reliable corporals, Corporal Hutton, and he went back and to collect the additional mines and so on the way back he was ambushed by a Chinese patrol and they were shot up. He fell into a ditch. He was slightly wounded with a two or three burp gun, the sort of submachine gun the Chinese had, and fell into a ditch and avoided being captured or anything else. But the drivers and another sapper, there were two or three of them, were taken prisoner by the Chinese and marched straight through our own lines, and they went straight down the boundary line between the KOSB and the KSLI. And it was the classic story of the IO of, say, the KSLI calling up his compatriot in the KOSB and saying, look, there's a patrol moving out. It's not ours. Is it one of yours? I have no notice of this, because they always exchange notes about patrol timings as a matter of routine. And they checked and said, no, it's not one of ours. There's nothing been laid on other than that was agreed for the night. And by the time this communication had been finished, and then they began to realize something had gone wrong, the patrol and my sappers had got clear away. The sappers, meantime, had their boots removed and had to march either barefoot on their stocking feet straight down to avoid making any additional noise. I have to say that the sappers were recovered a year or two later at the exchange of prisoners in Panmunjom. So that was a happy ending, but it was a very unhappy night.
How many of them were actually taken prisoner on that occasion?
I think there were three of them, yes.
Three. So you've got a carrying party of four, yeah, with a corporal in charge.
Well, that was just, there were just the drivers,
yes.
Corporal Hutton, who escaped.
Yes.
And a couple of chaps to help load and unload. Yeah. But they were taken clean through our lines, and it was very clear that the Chinese knew where the junction point was, where the boundary was, and made full use of that.
Did you have any idea of how big the Chinese patrol was?
No, I didn't. I didn't really appreciate what was happening,
yes,
until I came back in wondering why the second batch of mines hadn't come up. Then it all came out, what happened.
Had you got a protection party out that night to cover your front?
Not really, no. We were within earshot of the line, so we didn't have anything special there.
Yeah.
But after that time, all movement at night of that sort was under escort. And you had, say, a scout car or a vehicle before and after every little column. And we never went out mine laying again at night, but either before or without protection, just in case.
When you got your Sappers back, did they say anything about the way they'd been treated while they were I had
long since gone. You see, it wasn't until the exchange of prisoners after the final armistice in July 53, and I had gone home.
Did you meet them again, or did you just hear that they'd
I never saw them again. I just had a report that they had come out safely, and Sappers, who were at the time welcoming them back, they let me know, but they never came to any of our subsequent reunions, perhaps understandably after that experience. But I know they got back safely.
What happened to Corporal Hutton?
He went away, recovered after hospital treatment, was promoted sergeant and came back and became my recce sergeant.
Was he badly shaken up by this?
He was at the time, but the wounds were not terribly serious. I mean, two or three machine gun, submachine gun bullets are bad enough for anyone. But he made a good recovery and became a very effective troop recce sergeant. My previous sergeant had gone home with a military medal.
Now, at this time, was the character of the personnel changing? Were you finding that you were getting more National Servicemen coming in and some of the old reservists going back home, because time was getting on, wasn't
it? Well, by that stage, which was well after Commando, the reservists had all gone.
Yes.
And we were just a mixture of regulars and National Service.
Did that make a difference in attitude or performance or in anything?
No, I didn't notice any real difference, because as the sort of level of experience was building up, it was carried forward. And newcomers were brought in and broken in gradually. They weren't rushed into mine laying straight away. They had a chance to find their way around, acclimatise, get used to it, practice. As I said, I think before, I could never distinguish on performance and behaviour any difference between the National Service and regular soldier at that time. They were all first class.
Another important thing besides mine laying is maintaining communication. I think you were saying that one time you had to take extraordinary measures to protect one of the bridges over the Imjin.
Yes, in the first autumn, 1951, the time of Commando, for example, we relied entirely on ferries and rafts across the Imjin, and I think I described some of that. The American engineers, who had much, they were bigger strength than we were, they had what effectively were core engineers and construction engineers and specialists in bridges. They had built a timber trestle bridge across the River Imjin with a nickname Teal. The crossing was Teal, and that was really Gloucester Crossing. And this was a very fine timber trestle bridge, which allowed a much more rapid supply and reinforcement if necessary to ourselves on the North Bank. Experience of ferrying and rafting in the monsoon season in 51 made us realise that this bridge could be vulnerable when the river rose, and it rose rapidly and to considerable height, with debris, flotsam and jetsam, coming down the river, and usually at considerable speed. And the sort of, it would be trees, small buildings, and one Korean hut was seen to be swirling down, and we anticipated this might cause severe damage to the bridge, and we were quite right. So an organization was set up. It was almost like a close bridge garrison, the forerunner of the demolition guard. And I had set up there with under my command a platoon of the PPCLI infantry from the Canadian Brigade, a troop of Lords Strathcona Horse, their armored regiment, a detachment of searchlights, and my sapper troop. And the object of the exercise was, A, to make sure that the debris coming down the river in the flood season would not damage the bridge or cause it to be washed away. And we had two tanks on each bank covering a considerable stretch. We had searchlights on each bank for night, and the Canadian PPCLI platoon was really give us protection should anything happen and the Chinese realize and take advantage if it came to that. It was more of a token gesture than anything else. But
sounds
they were
like a local security force.
Just a local security
real
force.
Defense.
That was all.
Yes.
And jolly nice chaps they were to be with too. Mm. And we had quite a bit of fun occasionally shooting up large bits of flotsam and debris coming down. But I have to say that you know, I handed over after a certain point, and my successors had a very nasty time because the bridge actually was washed away. And we tried everything. We had piles in front of the trestle piers to divert the debris. We used techniques like simple, like fishing, with long bamboo poles with charges of plastic explosives lowered down to try and blow up the debris. But in the end, it defeated us, and the bridge was washed out.
It appears from this that one of the most important factors in this sort of work would be that the weather. Did you have good and regular information about the weather prospects, meteorology?
We didn't have much in that. There was a weather forecast, but we knew the seasons, and they were fairly regular. Spring was delightful. Summer got very, very hot. The monsoon season, it got hot and sticky and then got very wet, and we knew there'd be torrential rain, and the river kept, and then we knew the winter would be cold and damp and then cold and frosty. So it was perhaps generally more predictable than we're used to in this country. But when the monsoon season was coming, we set up a river watch with measuring poles had been established. And their job, when the rain started seriously, was to record the level of the water rising. And that was done on a sort of hourly basis, so that we could see when the critical period was coming. And we knew within a week or two when it was going to be.
Did you know if they ever contemplated schemes to engineer the river, to make its flow of water more controllable? Was there any?
No, nothing like that. No. Luckily, there was another bridge at a place called Pintail, right, further up the river, and because it was realised that the timber trestle bridge was vulnerable, this was a metal structure, steel girder bridge, which again the Americans were putting in. That survived the floods, although at one time, I wasn't there, but I heard afterwards that they had in fact got bulldozers with cables to the bridge and holding it back just in case something should happen. But the bridge at Pintail, nicknamed, I think, the Peace Bridge, stayed in place.
So they're able to anchor that?
They anchored it just in case, and there were dangers of it moving, but it survived. Yeah. Later on, the high-level timber trestle bridge at Teal, which was washed out, was replaced by a low-level concrete metal bridge. And the idea, and it was still there when I went back in 1990, that it, for most of the year it was in operation and it was very sound and saved ferrying and rafting. When the rainy season came, they just said, let the water flow over it. And it would be only for a few critical weeks that would be the case.
Could you still use it when it was underwater?
No.
You couldn't use it underwater bridge.
It was a dry bridge for most of the year. It became what we call an Irish bridge when the water was just over it. Mm. And then when the water level rose, they stopped using it. Mm. By that time, it wasn't critical, of course. The armistice had come and so on.
What was the river bed like?
It was a gravel shingle bed. Bit of sand, but mostly sort of a gravelly bed. Quite a good foundation for driving in piers and piles for that sort of operation.
It's got favourable geology for bridge building.
Yes, the banks weren't quite so favourable. They were earth banks, but they were they had been bulldozed down, and the soft soil was away. The high-level bridge was the answer if you could guarantee its survival.
That would mean building ramps, wouldn't it, on the banks? Mm. And would that mean simply compacting the soft earth, or did you have to bring in hardcore and other materials?
Later on, hardcore was dumped, yes. Yeah. But at that sort of stage, the high-level bridge, it wasn't necessary so much. It's when they went down the cliffs.
Yes.
Drop of 40 or 50 feet, perhaps, I can't remember exactly.
That would be a considerable gradient, wouldn't it?
It was quite a gradient,
a long ramp.
Yeah. And there, as a matter of routine, there was always a recovery vehicle at either end of the crossing. just in case. Because even with the bridge in place, you had to have the recovery to avoid the bridge being blocked.
Was it only a sort of one lane wide?
It was a one lane, one lane width bridge, the teal timber trestle one. Yes.
Could that timber bridge take tanks? Would it take armour?
Yes, it was a very strong bridge. For a timber, yes, it would. Timber trestle was steel girders across the top,
yes.
Whereas Pintail had steel trestles, if you like. The whole structure was steel.
Do you know what sort of timber they'd used and whether it had been acquired locally or would have been shipped in from
I would suspect
Korea?
It was shipped in. The Americans are a very good logistic organization. Yes. And, for example, I had to build a smallish bridge once over a stream. And the decision was taken to put a timber thing with steel girders. And I consulted the Americans who were going to supply the material, and they came up really with a book of blueprints.
Yes.
And they said, what sort of bridge do you want? What's the gap? What class of vehicles do you expect to cross it? Is it going to be a class 40 or a class 50 or a class 30? That's, generally speaking, roughly the weight in tons of the vehicles crossing over it. And I gave them the measurements and the estimated bridge classification, and they just went over and said, oh, here we are. This is it. And the plan came with a complete stores package.
This sounds like a B&Q flat pack kit for making a bridge.
It really was almost like that. Yeah. And What I had to do was to mark out an area on our side of the crossing, little crossing. It wasn't a big bridge. And up came the Americans, and all the stores were dumped in the proper order, which we supervised as per the blueprint. And you just ticked off so many steel girders, so many timber blocks, so much of this, so many bolts and all the rest of it for the bank abutments and so on. And there it was.
So it was a complete kit was delivered.
A complete kit was delivered.
Was the timber all pre-cut? And
yes, it was all cut to the size of the gap that we said. And had it been a bigger gap, then that would have been a different package would have come up. There wasn't. We didn't have any of our own Bailey there, but the Americans had their own version of Bailey, which was almost identical to ours. The measurements were just marginally different because it was manufactured for the American market. But they did have Bailey, and in the early days it was used quite a lot. But I can't remember, and I'm not sure I ever knew why we didn't use Bailey in that case, but this was the decision that the Americans were supplying the material, and they did, and we fitted it together.
Do you remember who you were working for at that stage? Who issued you with the orders to build that bridge or cross that particular stream?
It was on a newish road that we were building, and it was an overall plan that hatched out by the CRE and the CO of the regiment. That was just what they would do. That was really a divisional need.
Yes.
They then said, right, this is the way the route will go, and we'll need a bridge here and so on. And that was that.
And the order came down from the division via your CRE and regiment.
Through to my squadron commander, who then said, okay, Jock, as I was then, your troop can take that one on. I was delighted to do something different from road building, road maintenance, mine laying and other things. This was, and the water points, this was quite a challenge.
Do you have any idea of roughly how long it took you to actually put the thing together once the kit had been delivered to the side of the river?
Only a few days. I had the only thing I needed was a crane to lower the steel girders in place. The Americans provided that. And once that was on, the rest was all by hand. The bridge abutments holding the bank back were all built by hand. And there was no concrete there and timber base. And steel girders dropped in and then the decking on top. It didn't take very long. But it was a nice little job.
Yes. How many sappers were there in your troop actually employed in doing it?
Well, actually, not that many. I had my recce sergeant my prime assistant in the bridge work. I actually used my Korean batman. And I found that he had been a graduate of Seoul University as a civil engineer. And so he was more than useful as a batman. Because by that time I had stopped using a soldier as a batman. We had used Koreans because it saved a soldier from doing that sort of thing. And he knew how to use a theodolite. And he was delighted.
So he was your survey man.
To get the chance to survey the thing in and work like that. He was thrilled to bits. Yeah, that was interesting. It was labour intensive compared to nowadays, but we didn't use very many men on that.
Did that occur during the mobile phase or
no? That
was the static
phase. When we were busy putting a chain of jeep tracks in and lesser roads for battalion supply, we only had one major road building, MSR, main supply route, which was split between, I think our squadron took it on, but all three troops in the squadron were involved for a while. It was a major one. And it was a good lesson in planning a route. The line was surveyed clearly. The points where the flow of water was critical were identified. Culverts were planned. Armco culverting was used a great deal. They were all put into place first, and then the hard core and gravel. And I ran a quarry for the hard core, and I had a gravel pit from the river, and with American equipment. And the quarry was great fun with tippers hired or borrowed from the Americans. We had 2.5-ton GMC tippers, but for this sort of thing you needed the bigger 4-ton diamond T's, they were called, and a platoon of American dump trucks turned up, and you had to make sure that they were used to full advantage, to start with mainly on hardcore from the quarry, and you had to ensure that you were blasting and breaking up, and the face shovel was in operation to load the trucks so that they weren't left standing idle.
A continuous line of loading and unloading, moving,
and then tipping. And one of the other troops had the job of making sure that was tipped. And then as the thing got better and the surfacing came, then the gravel came into operation. And I had a clamshell, a gravel heap there. And the same sort of thing, loading trucks with gravel.
Sounds more like a civilian engineering project than strictly military one.
Well, it was. It was exactly civil engineering principles. It was about the only time I've ever been involved at that level.
Was there any interference with this by reason of enemy action?
No, we had no interference at all. By very virtue of its title of main supply route, it was
too far back.
It was too far back for that. But it was the one time that we really... that I can remember, that we really had to build a major road that would be two-way in both directions. Others, we had used existing Japanese roads which had been widened or modified, and then there were nothing better than tracks, really, as opposed to the jeep tracks up the hills.
I wanted to ask you about the quality of those Japanese roads, about whether they had actually done anything serious to make them all-weather or motorable.
The few that we had were very solid, because they'd had to be to go across the sort of general paddy field type of ground, but they were all just one way. You couldn't get vehicles, so you had to have build passing places, and the impression one got, it was simply a network of roads that could get the Japanese landing at Pusan and moving through into Manchuria as quickly as possible.
Yes. So you're only going one way.
That was the impression one got. I mean, they were very solid, but not many of them, and they were narrow.
And did you get the impression they'd been built using machinery or by hand?
I didn't. I suspect not much machinery, but that was historical.
Yes.
There wasn't much around when they were building those roads.
And when you were running a road that's single track with passing places, presumably you have to have some sort of traffic control system to avoid.
Yes, the military police were very good at that.
Yes. So that wasn't your business, that was military police business.